all advertising, marketing, and brand communication should evoke some sort of emotion, elicit a reaction, or some form of desired action from audiences. In this episode, I talked to a creative advisor to brands and agencies, a creative activist and founder of Number 10, Ahmed Tilly. In his illustrious career in advertising, Ahmed co-founded an advertising agency called Black River FC in 2005. He has worked with many brands that shifted the status quo, from Nando's to First for Women. He has been instrumental in creating some of the brave, provocative, and evocative work that has changed perspectives in advertising. I ask him what brave work truly is.
Work that's unafraid to succeed, and let me explain that. I think a lot of brands do work that, you know, is aiming to not fail versus aiming to succeed.
We also discuss how brands and agencies can stand out with their advertising and marketing efforts.
If you're not different, you're dead. That's the bottom line.
To get all our latest episodes as they launch, hit subscribe and share this episode. Before you know it, your clients might ask for inspiring, brave, and evocative work that leads to interesting conversations. This is The Lead Creative. Welcome to The Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Monge Zimtati. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Ahmed, thank you so much for making the time to join us on The Lead Creative.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on your show.
You've worked with some of the most admired brands, including Nando's, First for Women, and many others. You've won and judged some of the top award shows, including the Lurys and Cannes. What, in your view, makes brave and provocative advertising and brand communication?
A brave client, firstly. Really strong creatives who are intent on creating something so special that people refer back to it at some point in their lives. And I think really sound strategic solutions were the most surprising creative outcomes. I think that makes for brave advertising. And I think one of the things I just want to add is the word surprising. The essence of creativity is finding something that's so different, that's so original. And the word that I like to use is unexpected. And I think the minute you're unexpected in your communications, you are technically brave because no one else is doing that thing.
Can we just go back to sort of the basics? Because we hear a lot about brave work. And this idea of brave work has been spoken about since the dawn of advertising, as it were. What is brave work? How do you define what exactly it is? I mean, you mentioned surprising, you mentioned unexpected. But what is it exactly? How do you coin it?
I think maybe it's work that's unafraid to succeed. And let me explain that, because I think a lot of brands do work that, you know, is aiming to not fail versus aiming to succeed. And there's a big difference. So there's the bulk of work out there, you know, is considered decent work, good work, but has no standout quality, right? And that's because everyone's trying not to make a mistake. They're trying actually not to stand out too much because of the fear of either doing the wrong thing or, you know, offending people or whatever it is. And so the result is like tame, calm, passive, and very vanilla work. And so I think it's very important to aim to succeed versus aiming to not fail, and there's a fundamental difference between the two. The bulk of the work that we see out there is really work that's trying not to fail, and there's nothing special in that. The work that we will quote, and some of the brands that you quoted, is known to do work that tries to succeed, tries very hard to succeed, and therefore stands out from everything in the space that is advertising.
I want to unpack some of this vanilla work, because there's a lot of it, as you say, and how we kind of, you know, come out of that vanilla work, or if brands want to kind of step out of it. And this is something that I want to discuss. But while sticking with this idea of brave work, being brave also means being different, as you said. It means standing out. And yes, potentially ruffling some feathers as well as a brand. And a lot of brands kind of don't want to do that. Have you found that brands are ready, though, for both the good and the bad that comes with being brave and different?
No, I mean, less people have the courage to do that kind of work. And I find that the bigger the brands, you know, the more difficult it is for those brands to do the kind of work that we're talking about, brave work, because of the fear of offending a particular market or not getting it right, not necessarily only offending a certain market. And the bigger brands, you know, have more to lose. And so therefore, they try to be all things to all people. I think that is the defining thing, is that when you're trying to be all things to all people, you cannot be anything other than vanilla. There's nothing wrong with vanilla. You know, yes. People like vanilla. Mm. It's available in every ice cream store that you can find. You'll always find vanilla because they know that someone's going to buy vanilla. But that's not how you make a name for yourself. That's not how you stand for something. That's not purposely. That is just all things to all people. So I think the courage to be brave actually by default means that there's the chance that you're not going to be for some people. And brands should technically have their people, their consumer base, and understand that those are our people. And so the bravest brands go, you know, as long as our market is excited by us, loves us as a brand, and stands by us as a brand, then we don't care that much about everybody else. Now, that's a bold statement. Yes. And the big brands mm-hmm. don't do that. The vanilla brands don't do that because they want to make sure that everybody likes them. And unfortunately, just like human beings, you know, you're not everyone's cup of tea. No one is. And the minute you are, that everybody likes you, you probably don't have much character or stand for anything in particular. And I think brands are the same.
Are there instances when you can be both brave and for everyone? And I want to kind of go to some one or two brands that, you know, in my mind as a consumer, kind of play in both. Nando's, we've spoken about, as much as Nando's is spicy, they're both brave and they're also for everyone in some ways. Coca-Cola, both brave and for everyone. Nike, both brave and for everyone. They're ruffle feathers, but they're both kind of brave and for everyone in some ways. And there are sort of countless examples. And the reason I ask this is because I'm trying to make sense of, can you be both? Can you be brave, provocative, and still kind of for everyone?
No, I don't think you can. I'm going to disagree with you. So let's take the example sure. that you use. Like Nando's is a product yeah. by nature is infused with peri-peri. That's not for everyone.
Right.
Even though it appears okay. to be for everyone, it's not. There are some people who have never tasted Nando's in this country because they don't have a palate for it. They don't have an appetite for something spicy, right? So they're not. In instances like Nike is a great example. I mean, it reminds me of that yes. campaign that I quote a lot, which is Find Your Greatness. It talks about the greatness in yes. each of us, no matter who we are. Having said exactly. that, the brand stands for more than that. So when they did the ad mm-hmm. with the crazy ad with Colin Kaepernick, you know, that upset a big part of the American population where they started burning Nikes. So there's mm-hmm. a brand that has product for everyone, but that isn't a yes. brand for everyone. So I don't agree that you can have a brand that is both bold and still for everyone, because there'll always okay. be someone. The question is, how big is that compartment of someone? And
right.
how yes. important is the compartment of that someone who doesn't buy into your brand to your business? Mm-hmm. And that's,
yes.
so you do look at big brands, and Nike is a great example that it's like sort of a mass brand globally for everyone.
Yes.
But it won't always be for everyone, because what the brand stands for, you know, not everyone subscribes to. So yeah, there's a bit of disagreement right. in your statement, but I think I've qualified.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, and I like that. I like that because we see some of these brands, especially some of our favorite brands, right? And because they're some of our favorite brands, it almost seems as though, why wouldn't anybody else like this, right? But just as you've said, it's because it stands for something that isn't for everyone. It may appear to be, but it isn't all the time. And I like that you disagree with that and you bring in that point, because that makes perfect sense to me. You've spoken about sometimes our brands get it wrong and they're afraid of being canceled and all of this. And we talk about brands getting it wrong all the time. That said, what does it take to get to that point where you get it right often as a brand? You've mentioned standing for something, and I imagine that it has to do with being clear what you stand for and being clear to the consumer what you kind of stand for. But what does it take to kind of, ruffling feathers because you stand for different, how do you get it right as a brand and get it right often?
Yeah, and you're talking about consistency, right? I think my interactions with brand managers or let's call them chief marketing officers and marketing departments is that they're obsessed with all the things that brands aren't, their brands aren't. Oh, that's not us. That's too male. No, that's too this. That's too that. As opposed to understanding what they are, not what they're not. So once you know what you are, and you spoke about Nando's, I mean, I've been blessed in that I had you were asking me the other day, 12, it was an 11-year relationship with the brand when I was at Blackberry FC. Nando's understands, what it is. It knows very clearly, and everyone who works at Nando's, for Nando's in my time with them, understand who they are. And when you know who you are, it's a lot easier to constantly be putting that out in the marketplace. And then you increase your strike rate of getting it right, right? But unapologetically knowing who you are and then telling people who you are. So that's Nando's, for example. But there are other brands, and I use Nike again because we spoke about Nike. Nike knows what it is, who it is, what its purpose is, what its focus is, what it stands for. More than anything else. And it's a good example of it. Like, they'll stand for athletes that, may not be popular for whatever reason. And so because they know who they are, they're not ashamed to endorse athletes that may have erred or may be not as popular because they believe who they are, the brand or the athletes who are, and they find the synergy between them. And then it's a matter of being unapologetic about who you are, being consistent in that message, and then consumers, people, understand, because they get the same message coming to them on a regular basis. And they understand now what the brand stands for, and they either buy into it or they don't, right? Nando's is a good one. Nando's has a track record from the time John Hunt started it at TBWA. All those years back when it started doing advertising for the first time, there were several agencies that did really good work for the Black Label, was one of them, MNC started to. And yet, they still do that brand of work because they understand who they are. It doesn't matter which agency they go to. It doesn't matter how many marketing managers are there, how many CEOs are there, who comes in and out of the business. The brand understands what it is. It understands who they are. Then the consistency happens. And then the chances of getting it right increases. And that doesn't mean you get them wrong. There are times when you get them wrong. But when you stand for something courageous and brave, that means there's a chance you're going to get it wrong. Yes. But there's also a much better chance when you're consistent in your braveness and your courage to be able to stand for who you are in the long term to get it right more than you do get it wrong. And I think that's the success of great brands like Nando's.
One of the things that comes up along these lines quite a bit, and it's also came up in a conversation we had in the past with some of our guests, is this idea that sometimes when a new sort of brand manager comes in, new CMO comes in, sometimes even though the brand purpose is clear, the kind of messaging that goes out to the market is different because this, call it, new person wants to make their mark as they come in. How do you almost distill that purpose and still stand for that and remain consistent over time? Because the brands that you've just mentioned and some of the big ones have remained consistent, have remained true to who they are and true to their message. And yet every now and again, as agency people, when a new brand manager or CMO comes in, you start feeling as though the messaging or the direction you're taking is different. How do you maintain that at brand level so that it's the same in your communication as well?
It's interesting because you spoke about a couple of things. The first thing I want to say is what a brand stands for is what a brand stands for. It can't change. Sure. It doesn't usually change in a long period of time. The acclimatizing of the new person in that organization is something that perhaps needs work because they need to understand the brand. But sometimes you have a CMO who comes in and wants to change and do different things. And I'm all for that. If doing different things is doing better, if it means going closer to where the brand should be, right, as opposed to moving further away from what the brand has been in the marketplace, as opposed to, you know what I can say, if the brand is X, then sometimes changing it from it being Y, coming closer to X is a good thing. Now you're talking about two different things. There are some people who come in and want to change something for the sake of changing it and move away from the brand essence, right? That's very unfortunate because anyone as a CMO in a senior position like that should understand what the brand is. If you get people coming in and understanding that the brand hasn't realized this potential or what the essence actually is, hasn't expressed that essence, then that's a good move to move be radically different. Different to what it had been historically, but closer to what it actually is, if you know what I mean. So I think there's good and there's bad, but I think if there's a tendency, maybe that's what you're aiming at or what you're trying to get to.
Yeah.
If there's a tendency of a new client coming in and changing everything for the sake of changing it, that's obviously not good for the brand because they will leave and the brand stays.
Yes.
As opposed to coming in and trying to make better. So I think as much as I talk about being different in execution, I think it's very important to be true before you've been different. And that's quite a critical thing. So I think, there are brand managers that come in or marketers that come into an organization, and it's their duty actually to understand what the brand is and then to do the audit to say that the work that we've been doing is or not aligned to what the brand is. And if it's not aligned to the brand, then we've got to fix that. If it is aligned to the brand, then let's do better. And I think that depends on who you're talking about, you know, like what specific situation you're talking about. I think that pretty much answers that question. Yeah.
The part of the reason I ask, of course, is because there's sometimes this level of disagreement, or sometimes whether or not you challenge a client as an agency when you almost understand, or when you've come to kind of understand them to stand for this and stand for these things. But at times, because a CMO or marketer wants to go a different direction to communicate what the brand does, how do you address that and kind of challenge and bring the brand back to its essence? I mean, I know that you also now do a lot of consulting with brands as well as agency people. So you are sort of in the middle looking at both sides and you see both sides of the coin. How does the agency sometimes bring the brand or help to bring the brand back to its essence, understanding what it stands for, when at times those levers of influence are tilted more towards the brand being influential or the brand having the power?
Yeah, you see, here's a critical thing to consider. Both the marketer and the agencies all work for the brand, right? We don't work for the marketer. I think that therein lies this big tension, right? I've always come from a point of view where I've always, and you know, anyone that's worked with me will back this up, but I've always put the brand first, and I've always gone, you know, this is what the brand is about. So I fight for the brand. I'll argue with the client about what's right for the brand and the consumer of that brand. And that's a fair fight because we all serve the brand. Like I said, you know, we are all temporary in these things because we move in and out of our companies and in our careers. And so we kind of dive in and out of brands and agencies, etc. What remains there is the brand. So I think it's very good to fight for the brand. I've been very fortunate in that the clients that I've done work for appreciated the fight. Now, the good clients appreciate you fighting for something you believe in, which is in the interest of the brand. And I always had to, for a while, had to justify that I'm not doing it to fight for the creative. I believe creative is the thing that helps the brand. I fight for the brand. But I've been fortunate in that I've had clients who've trusted me in that. So that's a good fight. Those are the good clients who understand that when you come in and robustly go, I don't agree with you, their egos aren't dented. They want to know they love that. They love the dissenting view in there, and they keep an open mind to what you've got to say. The bad client will allow their egos to run the meeting, where they go, well, that's my agency. Who does he think he is, right? Mm-hmm. And the bad clients will have very selfish reasons for doing the things they want to do despite what the brand needs done for it. So we are all ambassadors for brands. That's what we do. And I think that you get good clients and you get bad clients. And similarly, mm-hmm. you get good agency people and bad agency people with different intentions. So you can have, and this is a commonplace in our industry, you will have creatives coming into the room to fight for the work despite it being bad for the brand. And it's admired in our industry that you fight for the great creative work, which I don't think is right. I think you've got to fight for great creative work that's right for the brand. And there's a big difference. And when clients see that the agency is actually not interested in the brand, but only in the creative work, usually for awards, the agencies lose their credibility. Similarly, the agencies that fight for the brand and the client is fighting for their 13th check or their bonus, and they don't want to ruffle feathers in their organization. They want to do timid, tame, like we say, vanilla, ordinary wallpaper work. Those are bad clients. And they set a bad precedent and a bad reputation for the marketing side of the business. So I'm not trying to be all things to all people, but I know that it's true both on the agency side and on the client side. They're bad agencies, agency people, and they're bad clients. You know, and again, in a fight between them, you've got to come back to the brand. And I found in my history some great marketing directors and chief marketing officers that understand them. But I found that the founders of those businesses and the CEOs of the business more often than not actually understand it better than some of the marketing people. And so I have personally found that conversation with the senior people most beneficial, right? Because I find that there are tiers that drop underneath the CMO, right? And those people, most of them, are usually trying to second guess what's going to make the CMO happy. And therein lies so many problems. So many problems.
Right.
Great ideas get lost. Great ideas get toned down. Morale is broken. Extra time is spent. Unreasonable deadlines happen. All because of weak marketers who are young and who don't have the strength to lean on the seniors and give face time to the seniors to be able to present a solution. So I've jumped into a slightly different area there. But
if you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
Yeah, that all of that, I think for me, makes perfect sense. And I think one of the things that you brought up there, which I'd like us to unpack a bit more, is this idea of trust. Trust between, between the client and the agency. You mentioned that, I mean, you had that 11-year or nearly 11-year long relationship with one of your clients. And I know that you worked on that piece of work with that client at different agencies as well. How long does it take? Is it a time thing that where you kind of build that trust? Is it understanding, being immersed in the brand as an agency? Like, how do you build that trust? Because a lot of this brave work requires that trust to be there, because sometimes brave work is provocative, but not always. And we'll talk about provocative work, but sometimes brave work is provocative as well. So that requires that trust, that the brand or at least the CMO understands that you understand the brand and you have the brand's best intentions at heart. How do you build that level of trust? Because you would have had to be trusted by the brands you worked with to respond as quickly on things that are in the news and execute on things that quickly. You would have had to, how do you build it?
Yeah.
How do you get to that level of trust?
One of my clients, Coronation Fund, their slogan is trust is earned. And, that's exactly it. It's based on a track record over a length of time, right? I've been very fortunate again, like I said, with the clients that I've had, 11, 12 years, First Woman was close to 12 years, Mini was 9 years. We had clients that were with us for many years, which now doesn't seem to be the thing anymore. The trust in the agency and the people starts at the pitch process, right? In that early discussion. Here's the interesting thing is that a client, unless if they don't do this, I don't understand why, but a client can only give their business and trust their brand, and there's word trusting and trust their brand, to a third party if there's a certain level of trust already. So if you've done a conversation, a chemistry session, or a pitch process, that first step, they must already trust you for the long haul. Right? So trust is earned in step one. Then here's the interesting thing. From the day that you pop the bottle of champagne because you won the business and you go out tweeting the whole world about you won the business, to the first time you meet the client as the agency, there's zero trust. There's excitement, but you have to start building the trust again in that meeting, right? And so it continues in every meeting, right? What happens is that when you build up enough successes, the client, like in anything, the client will trust you more with your opinion. And they also understand you more through the process of working with you, right? Because they understand your intentions. They start seeing the results. They understand how you operate, how you treat their people, how you treat your own people, all of that. So like in any relationship, you meet a stranger and they say something interesting to you and you go, I trust this person enough to give them my phone number. When they phone, you don't have any trust. You are still thinking about it. But that first phone call, there's some more trust built. And then you go on the date, and on the date, you're again going like, I'm not sure if I should be here. And on the date, you develop more trust. And so it continues. And so I think time and track record are those things that develop trust, right? And relationship. Yep. And that relationship with your client is based on the work. I've always maintained that I'm a bad networker. I find like small talk very difficult, one. But two, I find the networking disingenuous. I find it inauthentic in a way. I feel like people are putting on their best, the best foot forward to charm someone over. I find that disingenuous. So what I've always depended on in my career is letting the work do the talking. And my interactions with my clients have been based on work. And the trust is based on the things that I say and then the results that prove that what I've said actually works. And then everything I've done before. So agencies need to build trust with their clients by constantly showing up and putting brand first. Right? That seems to be the theme of today's discussion. But when they put brand before their own brand, right, which is something that we tend to do, then clients start seeing it. And then they see the results and trust is built that way over a longer period of time. So yeah, I think there's no easy way. But there's another point I want to make, which is clients also need to earn the agency's trust. Just because they sign the checks doesn't mean that that's a signature for trust, right? That's a very important thing. Because I find that when we pitch for clients as agencies, what agencies tend to do is do everything to win the business and expect that the client, the interaction is the client must like us. The client must want us. But actually, the best work comes from agencies also wanting the client and respecting the client and understanding the client. So, clients should also be pitching for agencies versus agencies pitching for clients' business. Because in that chemistry, where it's a two-way street, trust is built. It sits in the middle of it. But the way it works is because the money and the check is signed by one party, everything is expected of the other versus kind of going, it's a two-way street.
Back and forth,
But time, take time every single day. I used to tell my teams, like, if you want the client to trust you, you've got to give them things, you know, to believe it. And that is on every interaction with the client, that the right intentions are there, the brand is put first. And with time, you start winning trust over and with track record. You've got to put your money where your mouth is.
We've spoken about our brave work and what it is. And at times, brave work and provocative work tend to be seen in the same light at times. Can you be both? And how are the two different?
Okay, so the difference, brave work and provocative work. Provocative work implies things that get you into hard water. There are very few brands that have a right to do that work. When I say a right to do that work, they've always done it. There's an expectation out of the consumer that they do that, and a disappointment if it doesn't do, right? So that's the reality, and I use Nando's as an example. There are very few brands that have earned the right to do that. But for the rest of us, brave is very important. And I like to change provocative work for brave to evocative work. Like, you've got to do work that evokes some kind of emotional response. Because if you're not doing that, you've wasted millions of brands. It makes me mad. Because I think that brands, if you count the ad spend in South Africa or in the world, it goes into the billions, right? But what you're putting out there is work that actually doesn't evoke a response, which basically means you've polluted the world, whether it's on screens or out there. So that work has to be brave. And what do I mean by brave? I mean it needs to stand up with its chest out and say something that people notice. If a marketer does not do that kind of work, the marketer should actually be fired, or at best case scenario, you know, the salary should be cut, because the marketer has literally wasted the company's money. I feel like it's a fiscal responsibility of the marketer to do work that people notice and feel something. That's the business we're in. We're no longer at a point where we're telling people what the product features are. You know, back in the 1800s, if you had to say, this is a light bulb, I maybe got my dates wrong, forgive me. This is a light bulb, this is what it does. This is what it's made of, and this is what the filament is, and this. Those days are gone. Now we have a million different brands of light bulbs. Why should I choose yours? That's an emotional space. And the marketers that don't create brave work, which is evocative work, then they've actually literally wasted money. So the difference is provocative versus brave/evocative. And provocative are the Nando's-like stuff that you get. Some Nike stuff actually still does that kind of thing. Virgin used to be able to do that kind of thing. That spoke, was outspoken, that ruffled feathers, that intentionally stood for something that was unpopular, perhaps. Right? Whereas now, we're talking about brave and evocative work, and a bank, any brand, financial services, anything that you consider to be a safe category can do evocative work. I mean, I've got example of that in First for Women. First for Women was a brand that was selling insurance, and everyone offered insurance to women. But the work that they were doing before we had started the campaigns in 2005 was not brave. And it took a stance. Right. And it took a stance that said that men do risky things with their cars. Now, that came statistically from data, going that the accidents that men cause create a worse damage and more frequent.
Yeah.
Statistically, women are safer drivers, statistically. Right. But to say that sounds really unpopular, because people are going to argue about it and says you're sexist with it. But that's a statistical fact. So they were brave enough at that point. They've changed what they're about now. But at that point, they were brave enough and evocative enough to say, we only insure women because men do risky things with their vehicles. Right? So that was brave. It was evocative. It wasn't controversial. It's not provocative. It is brave for standing up for what the brand is, and that's evocative work.
Yes.
Provocative work is work that, you know is going to create a stir, and you do it to get press out of it. And sometimes you do really offensive things people could possibly do because the intention is to make people aware. One of the old examples was Tommy Hilfiger. Tommy Hilfiger was an unknown brand. Unknown brand. There was no one. And they put up a billboard with, I can't remember the name of the brands, so please forgive me, I'll research it. But let's assume it was Armani and Versace. I'm just making there were other brands. But they put Armani, Versace, and Tommy Hilfiger on a billboard. That was trying to provoke reaction from people to go like, who the hell are you to put yourself amongst greats like that? You know, how can you be so cocky? And what happened actually from that campaign was that Tommy Hilfiger started featuring. So the intention of the campaign was to be provocative, to create, to stir it up, so that people would know who Tommy Hilfiger was as a brand. That's provocative. Evocative is some of the most amazing ads that you know, that you see on the screens and TV and everywhere, radio, that make you feel something. That's evocative stuff, and that's open to everybody, not just the brands that have permission to be provocative. That's the big difference.
Now, I want to go into the press side of things, because some of the most provocative, evocative, brave work tends to feature in the news. Before we go there, though, you mentioned this idea of permission, that some brands have the permission to do so. And in this Tommy Hilfiger example, it's them almost earning the rights to create that kind of work with that particular piece of communication. That said, most brands, or a lot of brands, want to be in that space where they've earned the right, or they have the rights to kind of do that sort of work. What does it take to get to that point? What's required? Like, how do you get there? How do you earn that permission with communities?
You're gonna have a big set of balls. you have to, like, if you're saying that the brand has permission. So by the way, I just want to talk about like Nando's, for example, right? Nando's by nature, the product itself, is hot and spicy, right? So its communication lived up to that. There was a reason for it.
Yes.
There was a link to it. So I just wanted to clear that up. Secondly, if a brand believes that it has the right to, and it hasn't done that, and now it wants to be provocative, the only way to do it, I said, is to be brave and have a big set of balls to go, this is who we are. We haven't been saying it that way. We're going to start now. And that means you've got to be prepared for disagreement, the dissent, right, from your consumers, because they're not used to seeing you in that way. So you've got to go in knowing that a part of your market may not like what you are saying about yourself, but if you're true to your brand, then it's okay to lose them, because what you stand to gain is a whole lot of people who buy and subscribe to who you are, the fiery, feisty side. So it's a give and take, right? You've got to go, okay, cool, we've been a brand and we are actually quite a provocative brand, but we haven't been provocative in our communication. We're going to now do that. In doing that, be prepared to lose something, but you're doing it measured, calculated to gain more. You would never do anything to lose more. So you got to start off by going, what's our intention? If our intention is to gain more consumers or to gain more love or whatever it is, you got to go, what are you willing to sacrifice to get there? Because nothing happens without ruffling the feathers. Nothing significant. Yes. You never move needles. Nobody in the history of the earth moved needles, you know, without doing something that's going to be unpopular. You know, there's a guy, an athlete, his surname is Fosbury. He used to do high jumps. And forever, for as long as high jumps were in the Olympics, they used to scissor kick over the high jump. You know, that's how they did it forever. That's how it was done. And Mr. Fosbury decided, no, there's a more effective way of doing it by going up with your head and then kicking your legs up with over with your back and kicking your legs.
Yes.
That is dubbed the Fosbury flip. The first time he did it, there were a lot of people that were really upset about, what is this? Who do you think you are doing this? Is it legal? All of those things. But he understood that he needed to jump higher. And he found a way to jump higher. And in doing so, he changed the sport. He shifted the needle. He got a whole lot of fans around him, and he created a whole lot more athletes that now break world records by doing it. So what do you stand to gain? What are you giving yourself permission to lose in order to gain that? And I think brands need to do the same thing. It's go, okay, well, what do we stand to lose? What do we stand to gain? This is a risk worth taking. And then the balls. Have the balls to actually follow through it. The other thing is that you can't half go through it. So another thing that a lot of marketers are guilty of is they go, I want brave work. I want to be Fernandez of my category. Yes. Or I want to be the this of my category. I want to be the Nike of, you know, pencils, whatever it is. And then they say they want that. And then you give them that and they go, ooh, that's a little too much. Then you pull it back. So what they do is they water it down to a point where it's like bravish, which is, doesn't exist. You're either brave or you're not. You cannot be bravish.
Or you aren't.
Yeah, finishing class. So, so I think that's another thing is that you have to make a decision that if that's who you are, then you've got to go for it full time. And you've got to be prepared to lose something in order to gain the greater good. The greater good.
You mentioned the press, so work that gets featured in the press. And one of the things that lead to that is responding quickly to the news, which historically with your work, you've been able to do that, respond quickly to what's happening in the news and thus become the news. What does it take to be that nimble and agile from a brand and agency perspective? It takes resources. It takes a couple of things, but it also takes responding on the spot. Like, when you were doing that kind of work, what needs to be considered in order for you to be able to do that?
Yeah, I think I will refer directly to Nando's at Black River. Black River, it's history with Nando's, because that was the thing that we did really quickly. It was interesting because what do you need to do? And by the way, I'll tell you this: my creative studio was small. You know, at one point we were 10 or 12 people in total. Designer, DTD person, plus creative teams, and myself. That's as big as that studio was. The brand is much bigger. The one, okay, let's start off in the beginning. You have to know what's going on out there, right? So everyone, you know, I hired people who were aware of the world that they lived in. They were interested. They were curious about the world that they lived in, from sports to, you know, entertainment to whatever it was, politics and everything, the country's affairs, everything was going on. And it's actually before social media, but they knew what was going on in the news. So number one, that's it. I used to personally, you know, go through lots of newspapers back when I read newspapers. We read the Business Day, read the Citizen, read the Sowetan, and read the Daily. There's even the Daily Sun, who gave us a really good indication of what people were talking about and thinking. So knowing what's going on. Then secondly, you've got to be fast in terms of articulating that into a quick statement, right? To a response statement. So you know something is happening, something is going on, something is bubbling, something's about to happen. And you come in, and I used to come in and tell the guys, listen, this is a hot topic at the moment. Did you guys hear about it? They go, yes. So someone would come to me and say, this is a hot topic. And immediately I'd go, guys, you've got an hour, 1 hour, or 30 minutes. Write as many lines as you can for Nando's, for example, and send them to me. Don't edit. Just send the stuff to me. And then I'd get like writers, art directors, whoever, had lines, send them to me. So I would sit with maybe 10, 20 lines in the morning on this particular topic and see, feed through it. And then basically go, oh, there's a thought. There's a great line. Can you fix that thought? And then that was essentially a selection of two or three lines, sometimes one, which I then sent to the client. Second point, you have to have trust with the client. So the client understood, you know, that the agency was going to deliver something solid. They look at the stuff and then they knew it was topical. So they made a decision quickly and said, yes or no, we don't want to comment on that. So let it go. And they go, oh, yes, do this up. And we'd have it done up almost immediately in a format, whatever the format was. And like I said to you earlier, back in the day before Twitter was even around, we used to basically send out the ad, the digital format of that ad with a line on it, out to all our email addresses. That's as basic as it was. And everyone in the agency would get sent this piece of work and they would send it out to everyone. Or we would publish it as a press ad in the next day's newspaper. So that was still a little traditional. So it was one press ad. And if the topic and the tone and all of that was right, people would, it would go viral. People would talk about it. They would take pictures of it. They would send it around, et cetera, et cetera, and talk about it. So it took us, firstly, understanding where people are, the market is, what's happening around in the world. Number two, speed and being nimble. So not going like, oh, I've got to work this into the system, blah, 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 like we normally do and go, this is the thing, 30 minutes of your morning while you're having your coffee. Trust with the client, you know, to respond quickly and then putting it out there. And then putting it out there is brave because if it happens so quickly, you don't have time to overthink it, to filter it, to show it to 100 people. So accountability is the last thing. The clients who approved it were given the accountability and the freedom to make the decision. So didn't have to go up a level and down a level and up a level and down a level. Went to these people, they made a decision, went to it. And then 9 out of 10 times, you know, it worked. People started expecting landlords to say something. And I think Black River's, I was at Black River, its greatest contribution to landlords was to create the social commentary, because it didn't exist really before that. And what we managed to do is do enough of these things, well enough, for people to expect the brand to say things. Obviously now they've developed into saying things in a bigger ways and using digital more, in a more savvy way, whatever. But the idea of a brand that responds topically was because, you know, Black River was quick enough and the client was quick enough to respond and gave us permission to do that regularly. That's how that worked.
Now, one of the things that I get out of that, you were a small and nimble team yourself. You had a contact within the client themselves who would approve the work. What I also get a sense of is this thing that sometimes a client can essentially take over a lot of your time as a team. How do you balance that? How do you balance that? You know, being evocative, being brave, having that social commentary and responding quickly and not having one client take up a lot of time within the team and a lot of resources.
I don't know if they took any more time.
Sure.
Because I think that the tactical opportunities didn't happen every day. So, you know, they would happen periodically, at which point we, instead of waiting for a brief from the client, we would take it to them. And sometimes they would tell us we want to talk about something. But it didn't take, maybe that was additional time, but really to create brave work is no different in terms of the time spent on it than any other time in the agency. We would get a brief, and I think this applies not to Black River, but in my experience in any agency that I work at, you get a brief, your view, the way you view that work is to make that piece of work as evocative as possible, as special as possible, as contagious as possible. And what you put in front of client is within the same time. How the client comes back to you and back and forth, you know, goes in waves. Clients have busy periods and they have less busy periods. Mm-hmm. So they have campaign time and they have off campaign time. They have always on time. So it's no different. I mean, a client demands more time, but if you spend the time you have with client in a more quality way, right, then it's going to work. I think a lot of time is spent with client, too much time spent with client and client with agency when you're not getting things right. If you're effective, That's where you actually can do amazing work without spending any more time than you should. You know this. You'll have reverts go up and down, and a specific project can be in the system for months on end. That is a waste of good money. And it's usually because of one of two things. Indecision, i.e. bad client, or poor quality creative and strategy work on the agency side. It's always, I'm not trying to play, you know, the nice guy for both sides, but I've seen both work. I've seen both be a problem. So I've seen where the creative you're putting in front of the client is nowhere close to what the client knows this campaign needs to do. It's inferior work. Mm-hmm. It's inferior thinking. And so it goes to client, and then there's the politeness of going, ooh, we hate this, but not saying it, right? So what they do is they try and express, oh, we think maybe this must change and that must change. So you come back and change it. And you present it back to client. This client says, client goes, nah, I still don't like it. And then the agency goes, but you said you wanted it. So there isn't candor. You know, I sometimes do these talks, and I take in, Harry Potter's magic wand, and I call it the honesty stick. It works like magic. Right? When you take an honesty stick, a wand, into a boardroom, and you say, here's the magic wand. It's in your hand. You are allowed to say whether you like it or don't like it and why, but be honest about it. I want to know that you hate it.
Yes.
Then I want to know why. Mm. So that I have an opportunity to take the honesty stick and say, actually, I think you're wrong. So anyway, in between, the time a client takes too much of an agency's time, it's usually because the client doesn't know what they want or the agency is not producing good enough work for the client. Those are the only two reasons. Right? And that's when it becomes expensive. For the client and for the agency. And the expense doesn't just come in money. The greatest expense is people. If you talk about burnout, demoralize people, cynicism in agencies, people wanting to leave our industry, what they believe is abuse, which is true, is because of these two things. Either produce better creative work for the client or be a better client, right? One of the two, and we can get rid of all this unreasonable deadlines that clients sometimes put on us, whatever those things are, all because the creative thinking needs to be solid or the client needs to be better. Finish in blood. Those are the two reasons. And if you don't have that, now you're looking for trouble. You're looking for trouble, and there's so many brands and so many agencies being faced with this on a daily basis. And everyone, well, agencies are afraid to lose the client, so they don't want to tell them what the problem is. Right? And clients, you know, kind of don't deal with their own bad marketing people. And so, you know, this gets prolonged. People leave, and it costs agency money, costs brands money because they put out bad work out there. It's a mess. It's a mess.
You've touched on the fact that very few brands play in the brave space. Most brands are vanilla. For brands that want to start taking steps towards being braver, towards being more evocative, towards being more provocative, what should they do? Where should they start?
They should ask for it. So it sounds silly, but I believe this. I did a talk the other day and I said, you know, you've got to ask for it. I always tell clients, ask your agency to give you a certain kind of work. So clients don't do that, they assume that it's going to happen. So imagine we've got this campaign. I would like a campaign that is spoken about by all South Africans. I want a campaign that is going to be so different to our competitors that it's never been done before. When you ask for that kind of work, you'll get it. And then if you don't get it from your agency, then you probably have the wrong agency. But clients don't ask for it because that means they have to buy it. They have to. If you ask for that work, you've got to buy the things. You know, I always tell my clients, careful what you wish for. You tell me you want a Nando's this or you want that. So, but I think you said one of the steps for brands that want to do that kind of work. Number one, ask your agency for that kind of work. Number two, get into some details. Your briefs must be simpler and more single-minded. Right? We know that's a common problem. Three, state the problem that you're experiencing, not the solution. So a brief should tell you that we are struggling to sell to, you know, people who are women or men. We are struggling to sell to 20-year-olds, whatever. That's our problem. Find a solution. Because what clients will do is that in between, in the mix somewhere, it will say that we're trying to aim at 18 to 24 young females, and you don't look, as opposed to telling you what the problem is. And then they go on to tell you that we need a radio campaign and we need a digital campaign always on in a social media campaign. They're giving you solutions to their own problem. They're asking you to execute the solution. Maybe the solution is not that at all. Maybe the solution for 20-year-olds is to be on campuses. I'm just making it up. So I think that if you want to do that kind of work, understand your problem, ask for the solution, ask for great work from the agencies, be simple about it, and lastly, be open-minded when they come back to you with solutions, right? Because if you are asking for unexpected, then don't expect the expected. Like, you must expect the unexpected, and that's a discomfort. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty much the basic thing. But it all starts out with the decision. You've got to make the decision that we want to do something different. And then you ask for it. Sorry, I went a long way around because I was working out my head.
No, that makes that. It's good that you did.
The billboard to clients, the billboard to clients is if you want great work, make the decision that you want and then ask for it.
In closing, Ahmed, just one last question. What should agencies, marketers, and brands do, or at least think about, to make their work stand out in a noisy marketplace?
It's such an intuitive thing for me. Like, I feel like if you're not thinking naturally about making work that stands out in the marketplace, then what are you doing there? You know, like I really think that it should be the center of agencies and marketers, like as a combined industry. The whole point of us existing is to gain the attention and the love of our consumers. How do you gain attention and love? You cannot put the same things out there, right? You can't, because it won't be seen. So there's no attention. And then you cannot get love if no one is looking at you, right? So yes. For me, it's like, I find it strange, because when you get into marketing, when you get into advertising, the reason for getting into it can be nothing other than creating work that people see or experience and love. Those are the only two reasons you get into. And if you're starting to think about how you should do that, then I think our previous answer is it, where you go, accept that you want that kind of work because you haven't had it. So make the decision to do that kind of work and then ask for it. But really, it's the basis of our industry to be different and to be loved. That's the only two ways you're going to get what you need.
On that note, thank you very much for making the time to share your insights with us. There's a lot in that. And I think we've almost looped back at the end here towards being brave, think different, and all of that. And I think in another conversation that I'd love to unpack is it looks and feels as though everything's been done. It looks and feels as though everything is out there whenever you search for it. But actually, there's still a lot that hasn't been. There's still a lot that that human insight can kind of give us to make and create the kind of work that is loved, that stands out, that is different, brave, and provocative.
Yeah, it's interesting because even in advertising circles, everyone says, you know, everything's been done. I don't believe it. You know, I think technology has shown us how everything has not been done. And so I think if you start with thinking everything has been done, even though our references find things, you know, you're never going to create anything unique. And like I said, you've got to make a decision for these things for them to happen. And then the last thing I'll just give you with a soundbite, which I think is critical to this thing, which is to clients and to agencies. If you're not different, you're dead. That's the bottom line. No one's creating, or you're creating the same stuff, you've got to spend a lot of money, for people to see it. You've got to plaster it everywhere. So, and that's a wastage of money anyway, even if you do have it. So, you know, be different or be dead.
Awesome. If you're not different, you're dead. Thank you. Thanks so much, Ahmed.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.